At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
We'll talk economy with the president of the Atlanta Fed. There is airline news and grocery store algorithms and a little bit of Agatha Christie. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, I believe the 28th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been a long, very long, six, almost 7 months now since the coronavirus turned this economy upside down. And a summer of protests has highlighted some of the structural inequalities and the racism in American capitalism. Congressional relief, as you know, is stalled, so we are going to turn today to the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta specifically, and its president, Rafael Bostic. We have had him on the program a couple of times in the past year or so. Dr. Bostic, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kai. Always good to talk with you.
So it's been going on 4 months. We had you on in June, and I guess I'll give you the easy question first. What are you seeing in this economy that's different, changed, good, bad? How's it looking?
Well, I think things are going pretty much the same way that they were before, maybe with a little more clarity. So when thinking about the economy, what our team has really thought about describing it as is a less than economy, where there are parts of the economy that are doing quite well and are in full swing, things like the Amazons and the Home Depots. But then you have a lot of other parts of the economy that are struggling. The restaurants, hotels, small businesses, people living in minority, lower income and immigrant communities. All those places are struggling. And that's become clearer to me and to our team in the conversations we're having and some of the surveys we're doing. And it suggests that there really is a split going on, and disparities are getting wider.
Okay, so let's talk about what to do about it. And I will spare you the almost obligatory fiscal policy question, Congress and the White House, because we know what the Fed thinks about that, that you and Chair Powell and many others have been clear that fiscal policymakers need to step up. I want to ask you, though, about the Federal Reserve, because much has been talked about the last number of months on what you as the central bank can do about this inequality you just described. And I guess the question is, you know, central bankers talk about the dual mandate, right? We got to worry about inflation and we got to worry about jobs. But I saw an interview with you the other day that you did with, I guess, the Wall Street Journal a number of weeks ago. And you said, you know, we need to start getting creative about how we're approaching this problem. And I wonder what you have in mind.
Yeah, so we actually are being creative, I think, and in a couple of ways. So one is we've done sort of a more energized outreach to some of these communities that are struggling. And I've actually spent more time talking to local leaders about their challenges and trying to link them up with expertise that we have in-house to help them design strategies to move forward in things like affordable housing or preserving small businesses, or even how you think about connecting workers to training programs to get them repositioned. I've tried to be more muscular in terms of using my bully pulpit to focus attention and really try to have employers and policymakers think differently about what they might be able to do to make a difference.
Interesting phrase, trying to be more muscular. But look, and I say this with all respect, talking about a problem is all well and good, but when the tools the Fed has are monetary policy and lending facilities that are designed to support corporations and larger businesses, what do I do if I read the headline that says, oh, Jay Powell says the economy's terrible and we're working on inequality? I mean, what do I do with that?
Well, with all due respect, I actually think we do some other things as well. So, you know, one of the things that has been conventional wisdom for Fed policy has been when unemployment gets too low, overheating is imminent, And so we should act preemptively and proactively to stop that. And we've really changed our framework and strategy to say, we're going to let evidence show that inflation is starting to get out of control before we may take that stop. And my hope is that, and my expectation actually is that will lead to more people getting jobs and getting more stably attached to the economy.
Well, let's talk about those target populations for a minute. And I want to bring you back to the reason we had you on the broadcast back in June, the essay you wrote about systemic racism in this economy and what a drag and what an anchor it is for everybody, and that Black Americans in this economy are suffering disproportionately. In the 4 months since you wrote that essay, it's gotten a lot of press, and I wonder if you think it's gotten a lot of traction.
I actually do think it's gotten a lot of traction. You know, it's been a really heartening experience to put that out and see so many people reach out to me and folks that I know and say, you know, that really triggered a new conversation for us. And it's got us thinking differently about our role in the economy and our role in trying to overcome some of these barriers. And as an example, about 10 days ago, we had a conference with the Bentheim Center for Finance at Princeton, where we talked about racial justice and finance from an academic perspective, to have researchers and people who are really trying to understand how economies work think differently and I think more accurately about the role that race plays in what people can do and how we think about risk and opportunity. So that's a new conversation, and that came right out of the essay. So I'm really grateful for that, and I'm looking forward to more opportunities to create those new linkages.
Dr. Rafael Bostic is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Dr. Bostic, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Kai, it's always a pleasure.
Wall Street on this last Monday of the ninth month in this very strange year. Pandemic? What pandemic? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. October the 1st, in case the calendar has gotten away from you, is a Thursday. Not just a Thursday, but this Thursday. And I mention that because that's when airlines are expected to begin announcing tens of thousands of job cuts. Those airlines had agreed, as a condition of a federal bailout early in this pandemic, you might remember, not to cut the ranks of pilots and flight attendants and ground crews and management until Thursday, which is now upon us. And as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, those cuts are going to affect more than just the people who lose their jobs.
When I asked Janet Bagnarik, a professor at the University of Dayton who studies urban and aviation history, what the past few months have been like for the airlines, she didn't even pause.
Armageddon. This is the worst crisis in the history of American aviation.
A crisis for the airlines, for the airports, for the soon-to-be unemployed, and for the hub cities, Charlotte, Chicago, Dallas-Fort Worth. Robert Mann is an aviation analyst.
For every direct airline employment loss, there is about 7 or 8 support and derived job losses elsewhere in the community.
These losses will ripple across the U.S., even to cities that aren't hubs, says Kevin Healy of Campbell Hill Aviation Group. He says pilots and flight attendants.
A significant percentage of those employees don't necessarily live where they're based.
The hubs will still have planes flying in and out, moving cargo such as medical supplies. And because they had such good airline service before, those cities will have other industries to cushion the loss. More affected by these job cuts, says Brett Snyder of the blog Cranky Flyer, will be the smaller places, like Williamsport, Pennsylvania, for example, which will lose a regular American Airlines flight.
It hurts some of those local businesses. And it's something that if it holds in the long run that they don't have service, then it could be a risk to the economies.
And those cities will have a harder time rebounding when air travel returns to its pre-pandemic levels. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Speaking of early in the pandemic, as we were with that airline bailout, you remember when everybody was hoarding toilet paper? And flour, too, for all that baking we were going to do, of which we did a lot in my house, by the way. Well, with warnings from public health officials that the virus could get worse this winter, retailers want to be prepared this time around if there is unexpectedly high demand. But all the computer models that stores usually use to figure this stuff out are not quite as useful in a pandemic, as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
When you pick up orange juice or granola bars at the grocery store, you are being watched, literally. Video cameras and even retinal scanners are looking at where your eyes go, how long you linger, and what you touch.
If it can be measured through technology and money can be made, and of course it's legal and ethical, it will happen.
Eric Bradlow teaches retail analytics at Wharton. He says algorithms use all that data to decide how much to order and what the sticker price should be. And that works in normal times.
Now the question is, how predictive is that model going to be?
Not so predictive, because a data model is only as good as its data, and computers don't know how to factor in people's unusual buying patterns during the pandemic. Rudy Leuschner, a professor of supply chain management at Rutgers, says retailers are going old school.
We use the supercomputer that everybody has built in right as they're born, which is human intuition.
People's shopping habits have ebbed and flowed depending on the state of COVID cases or lockdowns. Computers can't make sense of this stuff. Retailers have to trust their own guts. Julie Niederhoff teaches supply chain management at Syracuse University.
It is definitely going to come down to a lot of calculated best guesses.
She says humans tend to overcorrect. Retailers may actually stock up too much, wasting money and warehouse space. Plus, who knows what people will panic buy the second time around. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Goodness me, no. I hated the idea of bringing him into the 21st century where he'd be able to Google all the suspects.
Can't have that now, can we? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 410 points on this Monday, 1.5%, 27,584. The NASDAQ rose 203 points, that's 1.8%, 11,117. The S&P 500 up 53 points, about 1.6%, 33.51. Kristen was talking to us about those grocery algorithms, so let us check with some major grocery retailers today, shall we? Walmart ended things just a little bit higher. Actually, flat, technically. Kroger gained about 0.5%. Albertsons up 0.4%. Amazon, which does a lot of online groceries, the owner of Whole Foods as well, banked 2.5%. The airlines that Erica was talking to us about, soaring tickers on the board today. JetBlue, 3.6% to the good. Delta flew 5% higher. Not so much good news from the TSA, though. The number of passengers the TSA processed on Sunday, just above 873,000. That is, get this, 35%. Of the number of people it processed 1 year ago. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Notch, another one in the growing U.S.-China technology squabble. There is TikTok. You've heard of that. That one's in the courts. There's Huawei and the Trump administration's limits on its dealings with American companies. Now there's a company that goes by the acronym SMIC, SMIC, to those in the know, China's biggest semiconductor maker. It's had a rough couple of months. Shares in Hong Kong down 50% since July. And over the weekend, it was widely reported the Commerce Department has banned American tech companies from doing business with it without special permission from said department. Marketplace's Scott Tong has the latest.
China is keen to pull ahead in artificial intelligence, electric cars, 5G, and its companies depend on American technology to make the computer chips to do that, says tech and telecom analyst John Strand at Strand Consult.
When it comes to chips, China had tried to move into that industry for more than 50 years without success.
So the ban on U.S. sales to China's SMIC will sting Beijing's tech aspirations, and China could sting back. Silicon Valley semiconductor consultant Linley Gwenap is with the Linley Group.
With the sanctions on SMIC, I'm sure there'll be another shoe that drops in the U.S., and it's not clear who it would be. But, you know, I think a lot of chip companies are just afraid.
Beijing is assumed to be keeping its own list of American companies that it could sanction. But here's the thing. Even though China's gone tit for tat with Washington on the trade war, it's largely kept its powder dry on the tech war. Sam Sachs is with the Paul Tsai China Center at Yale.
The Chinese government has been remarkably restrained, even when the U.S. government essentially cut Huawei off from its lifeline. We didn't see action from the Chinese government.
Beijing could shoot itself in the foot if it kicks out American tech firms that it needs to build its future. Still, Sachs says the U.S. going after China's top chipmaker could get the Chinese to pull the trigger. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Five weeks from tomorrow, Election Day. Although, yes, some people have already voted or will vote between now and then. The point is, this is crunch time for campaigns and the oh so many other groups that are spending money to get voters on their side. And they're trying to figure out right now how to spend tens of millions of dollars so they get the most bang for every one of those campaign bucks. That is true at this point in every election cycle, but this year, it's a little different, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains.
Usually, the most sought-after target at this point in the campaign is the elusive creature known as the undecided voter, a focus that W. Mondale Robinson says doesn't make sense anymore.
And I know the world likes to believe this myth that we have these swing voters who jump from Democrats to Republican.
Robinson is head of the Black Male Voter Project.
That slither of the election is so small, it is not worth wasting money on. Voters vote the way they always voted, and they will continue to.
To an extent, he's right. At this point, the vast majority of voters have already made up their minds.
About 1 in 10 on either side of the aisle say that they're probably going to vote for a candidate, but they have not definitively made up their mind.
Ashley Kurzinger has been researching swing voters for the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Very few of them actually say that there's a chance that they would vote for the other party's candidate. More realistically, it's that these voters may not be motivated to vote at all in the 2020 election.
And some campaigns are willing to make that happen.
There is a tactic that is being used increasingly, particularly through social media, of discouraging your opponents' supporters from voting.
Mark Mullen is the founder of the nonpartisan group Turnout Nation.
So you're not trying to convince them to vote for you, but you're trying to convince the other supporters of the other people just not to turn out.
Even if people are already entrenched in their positions on the presidential race, there are other races that matter on ballots this year, points out Jonathan Bidlack at the R Street Institute. In congressional, state, and local races,
to have an opinion about someone, you first have to even be aware of that candidate. In the context of a congressional election, you may not have that same level of name recognition.
And there are plenty of ways to spend campaign money to build that name recognition. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
It'll be 100 years next month since Agatha Christie published her first novel. The Mysterious Affair at Stiles was the title. And even after a quarter century, the Christie industry, if you will, is still going strong. The Guinness Book of World Records says she is the best-selling fiction writer of all time. 2 million books last year, and that is just the English language versions, by the way. Feature films, TV adaptations, and stage shows abound. So, from Devon, in the southwest of England, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on the lasting and mysterious appeal of Agatha Christie.
At the end of a long winding path on a remote wooded hillside overlooking the River Dart, the sprawling country mansion is pure Agatha Christie.
This is Greenway, Agatha Christie's holiday home.
Did she write any of her novels here?
No, she didn't actually write at Greenway, but it was the inspiration and the setting for some of her most famous books.
Belinda Smith manages the house for a national charity that looks after places of historic and literary interest.
The murder scene in Dead Man's Folly is the boathouse at Greenway.
Last year, more than 100,000 people from all over the world came to Greenway.
We have real avid fans. We have Agatha Christie fans who are delighted to be able to come to her holiday home, sit where she sat, sort of like imagine themselves having dinner with Agatha or picnicking on the lawn with Agatha or walking the dog with Agatha.
If she were alive today, Agatha would probably be horrified. She hated being the centre of attention. As she proved in this recording from 1962 at a dinner in her honour to celebrate the 10th anniversary of her murder mystery play, The Mousetrap.
This is awful. I never have been any good.
The queen of crime who shot, stabbed, poisoned, strangled and electrocuted her fictional victims was shy, unassuming and sweet-natured, apparently mystified by her success.
Sometimes I really can't believe it's me.
She'd be more mystified today. The Mousetrap ran in London for 67 years until COVID interrupted it. It's due to reopen next month. Her novels have done even better. Total sales of more than 2 billion. Tony Medawar organises the annual International Agatha Christie Festival in her hometown in southwest England. He says her enduring appeal isn't hard to fathom.
People still enjoy the way that Christie winds the clues in and out of the narrative and plays tricks upon the reader, which work on screen, on stage, and on paper.
And so, a century after she launched it, the Christie industry continues to thrive.
I am Detective Hercule Poirot, and I will deliver your killer.
Due out in December, a remake of Death on the Nile, the latest of more than 50 Agatha Christie movies. It follows the 2017 remake of Murder on the Orient Express, which grossed over $350 million. And more activity on the book front. The Agatha Christie Company, which owns the copyright and carefully guards the author's image, commissioned best-selling crime writer Sophie Hannah to write some more Poirot novels. She got the job after correctly answering this question.
Would you want to change anything about Poirot or bring him into the 21st century? And I said, goodness me, no. I hated the idea of bringing him into the 21st century, where he'd be able to Google all the suspects and look at their Twitter profiles. I thought that would be terrible.
Her fourth Poirot novel, The Killings at Kingfisher Hill, was out in the US earlier this month. The publisher, HarperCollins, won't say how well the other three have done, but Sophie claims they have made her richer. And commissioning these so-called continuation novels seems to have been good for the Agatha Christie Company too.
The sales of her novels have massively increased since there started to be new Poirot novels, because people have just been reminded that she's still a going concern, you know, rather than something from the past.
Like the Queen of Crime, the Agatha Christie company prefers to keep a low profile, refusing to answer my questions about finance. But a swift bit of sleuthing reveals the company earned $33 million in royalties in the latest year it reported. Quite a killing. Who done it? Agatha done it. That's who. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the Federal Reserve, it comes in light of our chat with Rafael Bostic up at the top of the program. A survey out from the Fed today, it's a triennial survey called the Survey of Consumer Finances. It shows that although Black and Latino households did report more and sharper economic gains in the years 2016 to 2019 than white families in this economy did, those increases were from such low levels they didn't noticeably close the racial wealth gap in this country. The typical white family in 2019 had 8 times the wealth of the typical Black family, 5 times the wealth of the typical Latino family. All right, we are out of here. Good day in the markets today, as you heard. Also, maybe a not great day in this economy, as you heard from Rafael Bostic up at the top of the program. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.